And thank you so much, Hogen Roshi and Yukon Roshi and Aho and the residents here. I've just felt right at home. That's one thing I want to mention. One of the first I'd like to say that it's an honor and a pleasure to be here right at the beginning of your ango, your practice period. This is a precious time, and interestingly enough, in Houston, we're also doing an ango. So I feel like I haven't left ango. And in fact, you can't leave ango. Perhaps they haven't yet told you that. And in the writing that Dogen Zenji wrote about this, and I think you've heard about that recently, perhaps, ango, he does say that this is something that all Buddhas do. All Buddhas do ango. They just naturally do it. And in the anecdote that Dogen relates, he says he told his senior disciples that he felt people weren't really listening to the teaching, weren't showing enough respect for the teaching, so he turned around and did a 90-day ango. And that's a good excuse for doing an ango. Feels like people need to pay attention. But in a way, we also need to pay attention to ourselves. So we do 90-day ango, and it's rooted in that deep practice. Buddhas do it every single year. It's an annual practice. One of the important things, and one of the reasons why I'm here, though, is that we all do ango. It's part of our roots, and our roots are intertwined. Our lineages are intertwined for generations. My lineage, my grandfather teacher is Suzuki Roshi. Your grandfather teacher is Maizumi Roshi. They all knew each other. They're all intertwined back to ancient ango practice. So for me, coming here really is the family being activated. So our Dharma roots are really interconnected. And part of the support, the entire support for my visit comes from Maizumi Roshi and Suzuki Roshi's grandfathers. So people in Japan really want us to stay connected, and they want this enough that they decided this year, instead of having special visitors from Japan, they would have special visitors from other Zen centers go around. So this year I was asked to go from Houston to the East Coast, and Ajo McMullen, who's a teacher on the West Coast, was asked to visit places on the West Coast. This is just background. And so I thought, I've always wanted to visit Fire Lotus Temple, and so I called up, then you invited me. I really want to come visit you. Oh, please come. But for me, this shows something about our tradition and the warmth coming from Japan, which can be forgotten because it's sort of hard to communicate. It's hard for all of us to communicate. And sometimes it's hard for us to understand. But in the heart of the practice of our family in Japan, it's the same desire to keep our family connections vibrant. So I was asked to see what temples I wanted to visit, and I wanted to come here, but I was given no guidelines whatsoever on what to talk about, because the trust is we will communicate with each other. And so in subsequent years, quite likely, Shugen Roshi will be asked to go and pick temples and visit, and other teachers will be asked. Maybe Hogen will be Hogen Roshi will be invited to go and pick temples and visit. So this is our family way. And this idea about, as I said, I came into the temple and realized I was still in ango, but Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, also says that to think that you can leave ango is a mistake once you've entered, and to think that once you've stepped outside that you enter again is also a mistake. It permeates everywhere. It permeates everywhere. So from at least that time, and I'm sure back in the Buddha's time, we've done ango the way you're doing it here and the way we do it in Houston, which is that The ango extends as far as we take our bodies. You take the ango with you. There's a story in Dogen's writing about Mahakashapa. So in the Buddha's time, Mahakashapa is a historical figure. Mahakashapa was the foremost of those who uphold the Vinaya, the foremost of those who follow the rules, famous. He followed the rules very, very precisely. So he had opened the practice period, and then the closing was happening. I'll say more about the opening in a minute, but the closing was happening, and he struck the mallet to close the zendo. And at that moment, Manjushri appeared on the last day of the practice period. And that was his first appearance at the ango, the last day. And Mahakashapa said, "That's not right." So he struck the mallet again to call all the rest of the practice period people together so they could expel Manjushri from the practice period. And Buddha, noticing this, said, "Oh, first Mahakashapa said, 'Well, where have you been during our 90-day ango?' And Manjushri said, 'I've practiced in three places. I've practiced in a demon's hall, I've practiced in a rich man's house, and I've practiced in a house of prostitution.'" Practice can go anywhere. Mahakashapa was not satisfied, so he still wanted to expel Manjushri, and Buddha stepped forward and caused, you know, these are Mahayana sutras, so I love this stuff, these images, but he caused countless practice places to appear, and in each one there was a Manjushri and a Mahakashapa. And then Buddha said, "Which Manjushri would you like to expel?" That's the story. But when I meditate on that, I see Manjushri going into all these places, and I see us going into all these places. So each of us as Manjushri going into these places to practice in a rich dwelling, in a house of prostitution or a house of suffering and misery possibly, or where the demons practice. That's where we take our ango. And then we come back, and then we go out, and we come back and go out, until the feeling of leaving the temple and coming back to the temple is seamless. And in the beginning of the ango, the description is that, in Dogen's description from about 1245, so we've been doing this for quite a long time, the abbot starts off on a procession to go around and do the opening ceremony. Sort of like what we do, what the abbot does in the morning when you go and offer incense. They go around to all the places, they go up and down the stairs, around the property, and people, wherever you're living or staying, you join this procession. And then you get to the hall, and then before the practice, or as the practice period is opening, all the people greet each other. And they greet each other formally with a bow, or if they're from the same Dharma family and they haven't seen each other in a while, their greeting has a flavor of celebration. And if they're from the same, if they're cousins in the Dharma, they celebrate right there. And in Dogen's writing it says, and if it gets too crowded right there, you can leave a note on the doorway for your friend. So when I read that, I thought, that's also what I'm doing with you. We're right in the beginning of our practice periods, and we're Dharma cousins, and we're saying hello. So I think they probably were as quiet as we were back then, but it does have a celebratory, quiet feeling. When I came in and I was given very clear instructions about how to approach the altar and make my offering, and I also make instructions, and it's almost exactly the same, but of course, because of dimensions of rooms and patterns, everything's always a little bit different. So one makes mistakes. Mistakes are made. And in this world, as we try to do things in a helpful way, in a way that supports the practice and causes this deep, settled feeling to ensue and all the good deeds that we're doing, we make mistakes. Have you heard the expression, one continuous mistake? You heard that? Yeah. So I looked for the source of that expression. And it's possibly, there are two different places where it possibly is, but I read the Dogen fascicle, the chapter called Awesome Presence of Active Buddhas, which is where it shows up. Awesome Presence of Active Buddhas. And that's Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation of the title, but there is a Nishijima translation, which I took out of the library upstairs and read, and he says, Dignified Presence of Active Buddhas. It's still Active Buddhas. It's either dignified or awesome. I like awesome. Awesome Presence of Dignified Buddhas. And in this, he talks about what Buddhas are actively doing. Nishijima has a very nice introduction to it. He says, Buddhism can be called a religion of action. Buddhism esteems action very highly because action is our existence itself. And without acting, we have no existence. Gautama Buddha's historical mission was to find the truth of action. Buddhism can be called a religion of action. Buddhism esteems action very highly because action is our existence itself, and without acting, we have no existence. So even when Buddhas are sitting, when they're going into their 90-day practice period, that's action. We know that that's action. So it's a powerful statement to the world when we do this kind of action. But something else happens for Buddhas. You know, Buddhas appear in the world, enlightened beings appear in the world in response to suffering. They come because of the call of suffering. And then when they are here, they take action, of course, but the description of what they do when they get here is that they sit in the midst of flames. So the Avalokiteshvara in the entryway right there has a beautiful carving around her head, kind of a halo, but it is flames, as you probably know. Flames carved into the stone, and it looks very artistic and kind of uniform, but it's flames. It's actually incredibly blazing hot flames that Avalokiteshvara and the Buddha sit in the middle of. And what is that? So what is the flame that the Buddhas are sitting in the middle of? It's, of course, the flames of greed, anger, and delusion. It's the flame of what's happening, what human beings do to each other. It's the flame of misunderstanding. It's the flame of suffering that calls them to us. And the Dogen says, he gives us another koan in this piece from Xuefeng. Xuefeng said to the assembly, the Buddhas in the past, present, and future abide in flames and turn the great Dharma wheel. Xuefeng, the Buddhas in the past, present, and future abide in flames and turn the great Dharma wheel. Xuanzha said in response, as flames expound Dharma to all the Buddhas in the past, present, and future, all the Buddhas remain standing and listen. For me, that's a very beautiful statement because the Buddhas are willing to sit in the middle of the flames, turning toward the flames, and the flames are also teaching. So the Buddhas are listening to the teaching of the flames. And Dogen asks a question that he doesn't give the answer to because we're sitting in the middle of flames too. All of us in this world right now are sitting in the middle of flames. So Dogen says, are the Buddha's flames different than our flames? And he doesn't give an answer. Are the Buddha's flames different than our flames? I don't know about you, but I would sort of like my flames to be a little bit further away from me, a little bit of a gap between me and the flames. But Dogen says the Buddha is merged with the flames. He says, I say, the Buddha is not separate from circumstances in any way. Dogen says, the Buddhas in the past, present, and future abide in flames and turn the great Dharma wheel. They talk about Dharma from the midst of flames. They talk about cause and conditions. They talk about love. They talk the teachings from the middle of fierce flames. But then, interestingly enough, the fact that the Buddha is teaching also is causing flames. So the fact that Buddhas are willing, knowingly and willingly coming into this world means that out of the non-dual, absolutely ultimate realm of Buddhas, they come willingly into this world of suffering and teach, meaning they transgress, meaning they act dualistically. They act as if there's a self here and there's a self there and we have to talk across to each other. That's transgressing. Those are the flames of dualism. So when Buddhas agree to teach, they're actually creating flames also. So in that way also, the Buddha's flames are kind of different from ours. And then, in that second phrase, Xuanzang's addition, he says, as flames expound Dharma to all the Buddhas in the past, present, and future, all the Buddhas remain standing and listen. I love this. So in a Chinese monastery, which would actually look quite like this, there'd be columns and a stone floor and a raised place where people do Dharma talks. And then the monks are mostly standing around. So they stand, and Xuanzang says, as flames expound Dharma to all the Buddhas in the past, present, and future, all the Buddhas remain standing and listening. So again, what he's saying is that the flames that cause the Buddhas to come, the flames of suffering, bring Buddhas, but the flames of the Buddha's teachings also bring Buddhas. Whenever the Dharma is being taught, Buddhas are, that's what they want to do. They want to go hear each other teach the Dharma. So whenever the Buddha is teaching in the middle of flames, the other Buddhas come and stand and listen. But, so even though we're in that situation, Buddha said, oh, I was going to tell you the place where it says one continuous mistake, but I made a mistake. It doesn't actually say that so clearly. It has to be extrapolated. He says, when we're doing this teaching, one step misses the mark, two step misses the mark, one continuous missing of the mark. So, but Buddhas come and listen, and then Dogen says, is it superior to be expounding Dharma and inferior to be listening to Dharma? No, it's the same. So the Buddhas who are teaching the Dharma are the same as the Buddhas who come to listen. No superiority or inferiority. He says, know that the Buddhas in the three times, past, present, and future, are Buddhas who remain and listen to the Dharma expounded by flames. When Buddhas remain standing and listen to the flames expound Dharma, this is wisdom surpassing wisdom. So when Buddhas go into a situation to address suffering or to teach, they don't go in as superior. They go in as equals. And Dogen says about that, how could it be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? If it's a Buddha, what they understand is our complete and utter equality. And they create flames. So there's something in this for me in our world, because we're very interested in action, because that's our life. Our life is action. And we're very drawn to working in this world of difficulty and suffering. We have to do things. And wouldn't it be nice if we didn't create flames when we do that? But I had this image when we were just sitting in Zazen about a wood-burning stove. You have wood-burning stoves up at the monastery, probably. Yeah. And when you stir the ashes, the flames will kind of come up again. So here we are in our world, and we get very settled in our practice, and then we go out and try to help, and we kind of stir the ashes, and the flames come up. So that's our way. And if Buddhas are causing flames, then we have to be willing to cause flames also. And then we do the next thing. So how could it be otherwise, operating in our world? That's what I want to say. And now I'd like to hear from you. How is it in this world responding to suffering for you? Or anything you'd like to talk about.
So I've spent a fair amount of time in Texas. My mom is from Texas. She was born there. She lived there until she was 19. When she left, she married my father, and they met when she was 19 and got married 3 months after, and she left Texas, and she's never lived there since.
What part of Texas?
Corpus Christi. Oh. And I've avoided going to Texas for the holidays, for the winter holidays the last few years, in part because of the results of the election, and you know, part of the tendencies of that side of the family, and partially just because I'm dealing with a little self-care and trying to figure out, you know, what how I bring dysfunction, like how I'm creating that when I see that. So it's happening, right? That's the absolute, and the relative is that I'm also bringing that forth, right? I'm not practicing it skillfully, and maybe I don't have to right now. Maybe that's being too harsh on myself. But I want to ask about you and your students and your center. How is it practicing? What is the Dharma in Texas? You know, how is it practicing in Texas, where you have a very different social and cultural environment than you do in a place like downtown Brooklyn?
It's not different from Brooklyn. And that's really true. The environment of the big cities is, it's a very diverse city. One of the students there, one of our residents, teaches in a school in Houston where 20 languages are spoken. And it's the most diverse city in the country. So walking around, it's more spread out. The only difference is there are fewer buildings taller than 3 or 4 stories. But it's huge. And I think I had some fear too. In fact, I'll tell you, I lived in our monastery for 18 years and practiced there for a long time. And before I started going to Houston as a visitor to do retreats, I took a really strong self-defense course. I just thought, I'd better be prepared, you know. But it's not like that. And it's kind of painful for me now, because I now am really attuned. I spent all my early years in California, Now I see from Texas the kind of caricatures of Californians come out. I don't know Brooklyn well enough to identify your caricatures, but but the caricatures of Texas are equally wrong, do you know? Although it's true, people do carry guns. Never in Houston. Houston is a big liberal city. All the cities are big and liberal. So one of the reasons for going around here and there to practice is that you get to see the story that you're bringing with you. So I really hope you come. I go down to Corpus Christi from time to time, so you're welcome to come and visit. You know, you can take refuge in the Houston Zen Center. Yeah, it's very important to go and put yourself in these other situations. So my first answer was true, though. It's not different from Brooklyn.
I was thinking about the metaphor of the flames, and it occurred to me that my way has been for a long time, and still is, to sort of hope that the flames burn me away, you know? Uh-huh. Like if I don't do anything, then because the flames are so hot and so intense and so close, maybe they'll just burn me up and then I won't, you know, and then something. And it's not working so well for me. So, but that's all I've got sort of right now. So I was wondering if you could help me, I guess.
What is it that you want to be burned up?
Myself that can't burn, that can't fight flames. I'm sure that I can't do it as soon as I start to feel the heat.
Okay. That self is already burnt up. There isn't really one of those. So one of our most subtle clinging places is to think that there's this permanent self that we can do something about. But all you are, all any of us is a designation of actions. Convenient designation with a name. What's your name?
Ben.
Ben. So there's this convenient designation called Ben, who is just the accumulation of all your actions. And there is nothing permanent to be burnt up. So the wish that it could be burnt up is just one of those thoughts that goes through the head.
So when it's time to do something, what would you suggest? What should I remember? Because I never seem to remember what you just said.
So what happens? You have an impulse?
It's more like the absence of it's like so total and global. My whole reality is just the house is going to burn down, so let me find a corner to just, you know, to just go to, like, you know, let it happen quickly.
Well, yeah, that won't work. But Sangha, you're not without your Sangha. So you should stay with the Sangha. They're the ones who remind us that there's this no fixed self. They relate to our real collection of selves. So, you can't actually be alone. So just remember that you're not alone. Are you in the practice period?
Yes.
Okay. You're in the practice period with people all over the planet. Your practice period has just amazing members. They will, you know, align yourself with them. And once you get into realizing that there's no fixed self, it's really fun, because then it can become kind of a game to realize how often we fall back on it. There I am falling back. I think there's a self here. There I am. There I am taking this personally. There I am worried about, you know, what somebody thinks about me. There I am. So maybe I would say enjoy that game. Take some comfort in that game. We Buddhists have lots of really good games to play. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
Roshi, I feel like
You know, that sense of self is what brings the flames up in me. You know, when my sense of self is really being triggered, you know, feel the kind of really intense anger, hatred, separation, at times like this, it feels very powerful, feels very, very strong, and I sort of, I guess, I've been cultivating for a very long time, so there is a almost like a very, very seductive force to take refuge in that self-righteousness and self-reliance and trying to get my way in, you know, but that when it, you know, I come into contact with others and I forget the self, or if I forget the self by other ways, then, you know, it feels free. It feels like I experience compassion, I experience connection. And so it feels much better. And so, you know, for me, like saying that, you know, it's, I guess, like for me, like what you mentioned, the Buddha within the flames is when within the flames of what I'm experiencing as the anger that I have created and the hatred, the sort of that arise within me, then I can wake up to that and not be seduced by that. But there is that clarity that I can manifest if I could do it, and it doesn't happen often. So I wonder if that's something can, you know, if it's related to what some of the passages you read, and also how can I practice it better?
You mean, is there a shortcut? Meaning, is it shorter? You know, our habits are really strong. So once we get on this wheel, our habits are really strong. And the ones that you're talking about are actually something that we can turn toward with a little bit of gratitude, because what you're talking about, and all of us have those things, they're very obvious. So they're really obvious habits to watch. There it is, the feeling of anger coming up. Wow, look at that. Watch that burn. And the more you do that, the more you see, and the less it captures us. It's anger going through. It's like the weather. It's like hurricane, whatever the latest name is, coming at us. And observing our habits is the powerful practice. Being willing to look at them, not turn away. You know, there it is. That feeling is coming up in this context, and I have vowed to watch that happen. The vow has arisen in me to watch that happen. It's hard not to talk about I, but because of your incredibly good karma, you have the seeds of practice that enable you to watch this happening. And same with Ben. Incredibly good karma allows us to see what's happening in us and to question it. Is this really what I want my life to be about? And then we watch it. We do the vows. We do the practice. All the being mindful of the habits that we have. You know, there's a lot of talk about mindfulness these days, but in Buddhism, mindfulness is allied. It's between various things, like it's between energy and samadhi. We don't just do mindfulness without energy and samadhi. So you need samadhi practice and you need good energy to observe our habits in action. And then they start to change without needing a self to decide which way they're going. You already have that karmic seed. But it takes a while. It takes a while. It's not an overnight practice, as some wise person said to me about 30 years ago.
Thank you for your teaching.
You're welcome.
I was struck by your remark about you can't
you know, if you think you're entering Angwa and then leaving Angwa and coming back in, you never really left. And I was thinking about the difference between lay and monastic practice, that I've been practicing a little while, and I aspire to close that gap when I get up off my cushion and walk out into the world. And it's tough because, you know, although the other side in monastic life is to walk through the schedule mindlessly. So when I'm here, you know, I put myself here. I didn't just get up and, all right, this is on the schedule. But as I walk through my day, I aspire to, I'm a teacher, and there are many challenging moments with students, and I'm at the beginning of the school year as well as the beginning of the Ango. And I aspire to be different with these students in front of me. Mm-hmm. I aspire to be more patient, mm-hmm. less angry. And in my personal liturgy, I offer gratitude daily for these students and their families for the opportunities to practice patience and all of the paramitas.
That's great.
And they still piss me off. But what I aspire to I've been trying to offer more gratitude. You know, like we have a short meal gatha that I'm sitting, I have a little office in the back of the classroom. I eat my lunch and I try to offer that. Today I noticed it's like, oh, I am too busy to do that. And I just ate. Uh-huh. And I noticed that, and it's different. Mm-hmm. I can tell, you know, that there's a subtle difference, you know, as I take my food, whether I offer that or not. And, you know, I'm just really, I guess I'm really kind of asking you about how you offer these teachings to the students in terms of closing that gap between between, you know, the get up off your cushion and walk into your life. Mm-hmm. And there, it's not different, you know, mm-hmm. this practice is your life. Because I know that for me, I aspire to maybe eat before each class to offer some mm-hmm. positive thought, maybe one of the four immeasurables, to cultivate something different for mm-hmm. these beings.
And sometimes you see it happening, don't you? Sometimes you note, because of your regular observation, sometimes one of these, your students does something that would otherwise be irritating, and you notice you're not irritated. Doesn't that happen?
That does happen.
Yeah, and that's a reward. And in practice, because there's no self, you practice gratitude for that also. So there's part of the kind of not so helpful intermixing of the Judeo-Christian teachings is that in Buddhism, there's no problem with being proud of your practice because there's not a self. So when you have that and you notice, I was very equanimous. In fact, I love that student doing that thing. You practice pride and gratitude and joy and equanimity with your own practice realizations. So there's a tendency, I notice, especially with people who aren't, well, I was going to say lay people, but everybody has this tendency to be so hard on themselves. I'm not practicing enough. I'm not practicing regularly. So take the mind and learn how to really celebrate when one small thing blossoms out of your practice. I don't usually say blossoms. One small thing really appears in your practice, and really celebrate that. It's amazingly powerful in the mind. And that's true for you too, Vadim and Ben. Anytime you notice that the habits are loosening their hold, really, you know, celebrate. Does that make sense? And I want to say one more thing, kind of autobiographical. I thought that I was going to live in our monastery for the rest of my life, and I met Daido Roshi there. So it was a great place to live. It felt like everybody would eventually come there. I didn't have to go anywhere. But for karmic reasons, I visited Houston, and then it was nice. And I took my self-defense class, but then I visited again. And I visited again, go back to the monastery, go to Houston, And I was uncomfortable at first, partly because it's so hot to wear clothes like this in Houston. But and various things. But they, after a few years, they said, and the group, that's when I really understood lay practice, because many of the people there had already been sitting for 20 years at a Unitarian church, and they were so settled and so humble, because they thought that wasn't the real practice, but so settled. I was really impressed. And they wanted somebody to move there, and nobody wanted to move to Houston. And then I really had an epiphany. It was a little awakening moment. I thought, oh yeah, somebody should move there, and it should be me. It's like, oh, this person has to go to Houston. And then I put a couple of conditions on it. I really thought very deeply about it and asked my family and everything, because it was a big step to move from San Francisco to Houston. And two conditions. One, that we have a building, because it's so important to have a building to take care of, and that they have a year's worth of some sort of small stipend for me, so I didn't have to like arrive and start begging practice. And those things came together in about 6 months. We bought a building, and they had a little bank account, and I moved there. Because of my appreciation of lay practice, the strength of lay practice, regular daily practice gets you to the same place as monastic practice. So thank you for letting me say that. Yes.
Good evening. Thank you. The last thing you said in your talk, maybe you can remind me how you phrased it, but I thought I heard not being afraid to make flames. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. In the context of what you were saying about mistakes, is that perhaps another way of saying not being afraid to make mistakes?
Yes.
And I appreciate that. But taking it further and investigating what might cause me to feel fear around that, for example, you're talking about teaching as being a kind of transgression. And I'm thinking, well, that's maybe more than just a mistake. And we're having this whole conversation in the context of suffering. And yeah, we don't want to be creating harm and suffering. And right, yet we're going to make mistakes.
Right.
And I'm not sure if I have much more of a specific question about that, but there's a place in there that I wonder if you could maybe just talk a bit more about.
Well, I think you're right on it. It's the same thing that Vadim was bringing up. There's a self that we might reify. And so the same time Buddha was teaching about not self, not a permanent independent self that exists from its own side, that's really it. He never really said there is no self. He said the self is this collection of ingredients that doesn't exist from its own side. It exists from everything coming together. And so one of the transgressions would be, and it just is incredibly hard to avoid, it's, you know, acting as if there's another permanent self over there and there's one over here. So when the Buddha was talking about Mahakashapa and Manjushri, it could be interpreted as if he's talking about as if there were two selves, because it's very clunky to keep saying the conventional designation of a collection of action elements conventionally designated as Mahakshapa with the convenient designation of conventionally elements conveniently called Manjushri. We can transgress and make it sound like there are selves in the room. But the mistake thing is really interesting. Do any of you do improv theater? I don't, but I'm a fan. And one of the rules for improv is make mistakes. There's a maxim. And one of the examples of this I read about, a clown, and this clown said that he or she, I don't know, made a big mistake in performance, and turned to one side of the room and said, ta-da! And turned to the other side of the room and said, ta-da! And I used that in a Dharma talk in Houston about a month ago, and the Doan rose up in the middle of a Dharma talk and said, ta-da! So, yeah, mistakes.
Some mistakes seem to have a greater impact, greater harm. You know, if we're doing improv theater, I'm not sure anybody gets hurt. But if we talk about action in the world, if we want to address suffering, ever address an injustice, our actions might very well, if we're not careful, create harm. So I'm aware of exactly what it means to make a mistake in that arena. And maybe that's what I was trying to get at a little bit.
Yes,
more.
And in that arena, it's very current. In fact, yes, I heard about some of the things that are going on here and in Houston and various Zen centers, because we're trying to delve into situations that have arisen as a result of mistakes in the past. And then in doing our best to kind of stir up the ashes and see what's happening, we make more mistakes. We hurt people's feelings. We clumsily tread where we're trying to figure out how to communicate and how to do things. That kind of hurt is very, very, very painful to the doer and to the receiver. And it's almost necessary. We have to admit that we're clumsy. We have to admit that we're trying to do something and it causes pain, if that's what you mean. Because the other kind of harm where we, you know, intentionally or out of neglect hurt someone, that's the typical kind of harm for which we apologize and atone and repent. But the kind that's stirring up flames in this context is the kind where we're actually trying to do good, but it's inevitably hurting feelings. And that it's happening in our Houston Zen Center too, lots of things. I get feedback because we talk about social justice, and there are some people in the group who are a completely different political spectrum, and it hurts people's feelings. People don't want to feel like they're excluded from the discussion. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
That territory?
Yes.
Yeah. So to be open and admit and ask for, you know, how does it feel what I just said to you? And how I'm saying as an example, I would say, well, how does it feel that we were talking about this? Oh, it really hurts. And then keep going, keep going, keep going. One principle is that, you know, we live in the conventional realm where all of these things are happening. And we also live in the ultimate realm where things are still and peaceful. But once we're in creating flames in the conventional realm, we have to stay in that, we have to deal with it in conventional terms. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. But I don't be, we have to bravely make mistakes. Be willing. Thank you.
So,
Alec.
Yes. So you spoke about, you know, how important it is for all of us and all of our various sanghas, you know, feel this sort of sense of unity and recognize that we are like cousins in relation to the Dharma. But how sometimes I feel like it's challenging to feel that sense of unity, even, mm-hmm. you know, it's easy to feel, even for me here, excluded, you know, as, you know, not a formal student. So how do you think we can just kind of get over that? And I know there is some, you know, degree of a feeling of separation for a lot of people. How can we like really get over that and really see ourselves as one unified practicing sangha?
Mm-hmm. That's one of those flames, that feeling of being excluded or not included or separate. That's one of the flames that everybody has that. And we just have to stay close to it. And remember, everybody has that. This is a feeling that we all have. So the flames of the passions, all of them, it's just the nature of being human. How could it be otherwise? And the more willing we are to see those things, the less it will pull us away from the good things that we need to do. So go into a situation knowing that you were feeling uncomfortable or excluded, and just be there. You know, that feeling of exclusion is not you. It's just one of the things that comes up.
Thank you for your teaching.
Yeah, you're welcome.
My name is Donna. I'm wondering if there is any positive aspect to those flames. For me, I feel like I don't want to say struggle with, perhaps I struggle with it. I'm sort of trying to figure out the balance of kind of claiming or growing into a sense of like power and intensity that I feel like I've typically suppressed, and doing that in a skillful way, you know, that isn't harmful to other people or, you know, or whatever. And I'm asking this specifically as a woman, you know, asking another woman, and I'm also aware that I'm of the people, you know, aside from you, that I'm the first woman who's spoken tonight. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
You're right. You are the first woman who's spoken tonight, but a bunch of them are at a retreat.
Okay.
I was told that.
That's true. Actually, we do have our Wild Grasses session is happening now, so yeah. Which is a women's session, which is wonderful.
It's wonderful.
It is.
So your question is, how do you express your power without hurting anybody? And is that it?
How do you... Yeah. It's like claiming that, mm-hmm. and growing into that in a way that is skillful,
mm-hmm.
That is not like sacrificing or disowning and I know I'm kind of in tricky territory here when I say that feels like it's a part of me, mm-hmm. because I understand, you know, obviously that's a concept, but that feels very present, but doing that in a way that is skillful and not creating harm.
Now, this is for all of us, but yes, for women and people who historically have the, but this is true for everyone too, but for women especially, that message is put pretty deep into the karmic stream. Don't make waves, you know, definitely don't start fires. And it's a nice time on the planet, I think, because we're watching that. We're watching the results of that, and we're watching different people's responses to that. So you can take some comfort in knowing that other people are making mistakes for you. So, you know, you might want to make some mistakes for them, too. Okay. Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Well, people are, you know, speaking up for themselves and in surprising situations, and kind of ruffling feathers and trying it out. Like you just made a really good observation. You know, the first woman who spoke, that's flames. It really is. Just to, you know, name what's going on is a very strong statement. And in fact, that's an extremely strong statement, to name what's going on. So you can find ways to express your power. The rest of it, like wanting to be skillful, is... probably too much. You might want to drop that one.
that seems important, though.
What?
That seems important.
Yeah, but it's not up to you what's skillful. And your self-definition of skillfulness might be somebody else's definition of not skillfulness. So it's up to the group to decide. It's up to the world to decide what is skillful. And you get to check, was that skillful? And they say, yeah, it didn't bother me at all. I've been told several times I can be more direct because this is Brooklyn. You know? So I would say, am I being too not direct right now or whatever? But you can be direct. You can say, was that skillful or not? And people would say, no, it's fine. Mm-hmm. I once apologized to my teacher, Reb Anderson. Oh, I'm so sorry. I was so short with you just then. I turned away too quickly. And he said, when? And I said, well, just then. I sort of abruptly left. And he said, oh. Which was good feedback, you know. We need other people to help us verify what is skillful and not skillful. Yeah. There's the self. Take that self out of there. Thank you, Donna. It's good to see you. Hello.
Hello. There I am. Thank you. Yeah. I very recently had a teacher explain to me the reason for a series of bows, and what he said was...
Did you say vows or bows?
Oh, sorry, bows. And what he explained to me is that, you know, our life is a series of forms unfolding, and that if we are mindful of the specificity of the forms of these bows, maybe then it'll be easier to be more mindful of the everyday forms that we're engaging in. Mm-hmm. And thinking about what you had to say in terms of bringing the practice with you when you leave the Zendo, I wonder about thinking of it in the sort of other direction where it's easier for me to be mindful of those forms here in a situation that has a lot of ritual. There's, you know, beautiful lighting and candles and nice incense. Mm-hmm. And in my apartment, there's, you know, cereal and an IKEA table. and I find that part of what enables that here sometimes turns into an attachment or almost a fetishization of things that are far away from me, that come from a culture that feels far away from me, and that's what enables my sort of elevated attentiveness. So again, I don't know what the specific question is, but I wonder if there is also value to be found in like bringing the mundaneness of life into the Zendo as well.
Well, the answer to that part is yes, and we do that. We do that. We can't help that. And the rituals and the forms are mysterious. They really are. And I know Mayazumi Roshi and Suzuki Roshi talked about these things. And one of the things that Suzuki Roshi said was, we don't know what it is that's bringing this Zen understanding across. We really don't know what it is. Is it the words of the teachers? Is it the food? You know, what is it? Is it the books, or is it chanting, or is it the bowing of greeting, or is it standing with a composed body? Is it learning how to sit still? What is it? And nobody can really answer that question. We don't know what it is, but you know, you feel it and you see it. You see people demonstrating this understanding, and they can't just give it to you by saying it, you know. Hogen Roshi can't just say, you now have the same understanding. So Suzuki Roshi, Mayazumi Roshi said, we don't know where it is. So for the time being, take the whole package. And then after 50 years, you know, start to change things. But we are Americans. We started to change things in about 2 years. So Daido Roshi really changed things. But trying very hard to keep something to preserve, to give to you. So that's the heart of it is everybody wants you to have this thing or an opportunity to touch it for yourself. And for some of us, the bows are unbelievably powerful. And for some of us, it's the sitting. For some of us, it's study. We don't know where it is. It's a collection. So I could say, like the great blues song, you know, take what you need and leave the rest. But you should never have taken the very best. No. Take what you need. And I could say that, but I would really say take the whole thing and just take that little person out of it for a while. Take the belief in a person. Just do it. That's what I would say.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you so much for your time and for your practice. I feel very nourished being here. I feel very inspired and encouraged. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening. Please join us on October 6th at the Zen Center of New York City for Our Lineage of Spiritual Friends, a day-long retreat with Mark Finn. For details or to find out more about ZCNYC programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC.